My name is George Edwards, and I'm Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Texas A&M University. I also edit the scholarly journal on the presidency named Presidential Studies Quarterly. I'm a political scientist.
And you've been watching George W. Bush for his entire political career, correct?
I've been watching him very closely for his entire career. I'm right here in Texas, and his father's presidential library is literally outside my door.
We always try to, assess how history may look at a president even before that president leaves office. And here we are, as the days tick down for George W. Bush. But what is your first initial take on how history may treat this president?
Right. Well, certainly history will view this as a consequential presidency. George W. Bush was one who fought boldly and aimed explicitly to make a lasting impact. And there's been major changes in public policy regarding the war on terrorism, of course, and U.S. foreign policy and homeland security, but also domestically on taxes, on education policy, on health care. And it's by no means clear that there will be major reversals in these policies. So that's certainly an important legacy. So we know that history will certainly, on a descriptive level, say this was a consequential presidency. What we don't know are the long-term positive or negative consequences of these policies. We certainly know the cost of the invasion of Iraq. We don't know the benefits, and the Bush administration has been talking about benefits to come. There are some areas, like the failed response to Hurricane Katrina, that we know costs, and of course we're just learning about the cost of the financial crisis, which is a very major policy area at the end of his administration, and we just don't know at this point how we're going to weather this. So there's a lot to be determined, if you will.
This is a president who has seen the highest of high approval ratings and the lowest of low.
Right. He's been actually the most polarizing president in polling history, at least in terms of partisanship. From the very first Gallup poll of his tenure, which found the highest level of disapproval of any newly elected president since polling began, to the fourth, fifth, 6 years of his presidency, for example, when there'd be a gap of 70 percentage points or more between Democrats and Republicans. And in the 2004 election and his successful reelection, we found the highest level of party voting in the history of the national election studies. And of course, one consequence of this has been the substantial defeat of Republicans in 2006 and 2008, because although he's maintained good support with the Republican base, and particularly the religious right, which is a substantial component of the Republican base, he's alienated Democrats almost entirely, and most importantly, I suppose, he's alienated a large percentage of independents. So that is also going to be part of his legacy.
He was controversial right from the get-go, having taken office the way he did after that brutal election battle and recount and finally the Supreme Court decision that put him in office. I guess was the die cast in terms of the idea that he would be both polarizing and controversial, just given those beginnings?
Well, certainly a difficult way to start, but he followed up on that by taking bold action or making bold suggestions with quite a different approach to domestic policy. And it's one that the Democrats really found troubling, because Bush was not a typical conservative. He wasn't anti-government in the tradition of, say, Goldwater or Reagan or Newt Gingrich. He was a big government conservative. On the one hand, for example, the No Child Left Behind Act, which is one of the signature policies of the Bush administration, is the largest expansion of the federal role in education since Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. The prescription drug benefit for seniors created the largest new federal entitlement program since the creation of Medicare back in 1965. So he wanted to change the structure of government and not its size. But what he wanted to do, and what Democrats found so troubling, was that he wanted to reduce the demand for government rather than the supply of it, as traditional conservatives wanted to do. So he tried to rewrite the social contract that has defined the past four generations of Americans. So he wanted to shift decision-making responsibilities from government to the private sector through partially privatizing retirement, the famous individual investment accounts, mm-hmm, for Social Security, through the use of vouchers and education vouchers that could be used in private schools, and health care for the elderly, the health savings accounts, and the partial privatization of Medicare and within the prescription drug program, through reliance on faith-based charities and welfare policy. So Democrats saw this, and they said, well, the true intention is really to relieve government of its responsibilities and replace public programs with a free market that values efficiency more than what we might call the equality of the safety net. So the president really was trying to move boldly. Some of these ideas may have been good. Some of them may have been not so good. The public rejected some of them, such as Social Security reform. But at any rate, you can see how they were different. It was a different approach to conservative policymaking, and inevitably led to a lot of conflict.
9/11 comes about 8 months into his first year in office. And those really are, even today, they feel like the signature moments of his presidency. The immediate aftermath and then the long-range response to those attacks.
Well, absolutely. It was the signature moment of the Bush presidency. It reoriented the Bush presidency. On September 10th, 2001, the president stood at 51% in the polls. People were starting to characterize it as a listless presidency, despite the fact that I think it had acted pretty successfully, given a very narrow margin in Congress, and given the nature of the president's election and the lack of a mandate. He accomplished quite a lot in the first 2 or 3 years. But nevertheless, this reoriented the Bush presidency. It gave it new meaning. And so we immediately, of course, started focusing on dealing with terrorism. So we had, in short order, two wars. We were restructuring the national government, which is a major, major restructuring of the Department of Homeland Security. And so everything was, in effect, subordinated to the war on terrorism.
You talk about him being the most polarizing president, but those 90, 91, 92% approval ratings that he earned immediately after 9/11, and which sustained for a long, long time, meant a lot of Democrats, along with independents, were pulling for him and thought he was doing a good job, right?
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the public was unified after this traumatic event. Indeed, before the president had actually given his now famous speech before a joint session of Congress on national TV, he'd already risen to 90% approval before he'd done anything. And I think that reflects the country's unity and response to trauma. And those approval ratings were sustained. We had a success in Afghanistan. We removed the Taliban from power. And there was a unity in the country which sustained itself for some time. But after a while, and particularly after the war in Iraq, and by the late spring of 2003, it was quite evident that we were having some serious problems there. And things started unraveling at that point. And by 2004, we were back to some significant polarization. The election was highly polarized in partisan terms, and there's been high polarization ever since.
Those high approval ratings gave him just a really strong hand in dealing with Congress. And he used it certainly to get things like the Patriot Act through and to ultimately take the country to war in Iraq, but also to really push his domestic issue as well, right? More tax cuts and other issues like that that were near and dear to his heart, but not necessarily connected to what he called the war on terror.
That's correct. He did try to leverage his approval ratings because he's sensitive about political capital, and he knows that it's something that needs to be used because he likes to think boldly. And so he was certainly trying to leverage his approval, and certainly in the restructuring of the U.S. government to fight the war on terrorism and adding the Patriot Act, and he did very well on all aspects of the war on terrorism. He got just about everything that he wanted. When it came to domestic policy, there was more conflict, and you can only take approval that was based on terrorism. You can only apply that for a short time to issues of truly domestic policy. So that didn't last very long. And even after re-election in 2004, when he tried two major reforms, one on Social Security and one on immigration, they both failed. In fact, neither came really to a vote in either House of Congress in terms of the policy that he proposed.
He famously said he had earned political capital during the 2004 election, and he intended to spend it, but he found out that the currency wasn't really worth a whole lot when it came to reforming, say, Social Security. He toured the country, and it went nowhere.
That's right. The White House was had a bit of hubris, first of all, in evaluating the president's capital, which he really didn't have, and number two, in evaluating the potential for persuasion. In the end, the president lost support for the policy, and the more that the president was associated with the policy, the less people supported it. So I think there's an important lesson there about the limits of the bully pulpit.
I'd like to just go through a couple of different areas and get your thoughts. Starting with George Bush, the decision maker. When you look back at his 8 years, what do you find particularly interesting there in that area?
Well, I think there are several things. I think we've learned some important lessons about competence in governing. And we've seen some bad decisions and not being on top of issues. And I think if we dig a little bit deeper, we learn some important lessons. You may recall that the Bush presidency was one that had a certain anti-intellectualism associated with it. And the president often describes himself as an instinctual decision maker, which is a view shared by most close observers. But there's a drawback to this. Relying on instincts can lead you to act impulsively rather than delving into a range of possible options. And gut reactions also discourage investing time in soliciting and cultivating the views of others and asking probing questions of advisors. So when the CIA briefed the president on August 6, 2001 about the threat from Al-Qaeda, he didn't follow up with questions or instructions or discussions with his top advisors, and we know what happened about a month later. Even more famously, I think, when George Tenet briefed the president on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction on December 21, 2002, the president, who's actually an intelligent man, said that's not a very good argument, that's inadequate. CIA Director George Tenet famously replied that the case was a slam dunk. Now, the real issue here is not Tenet's reply, but instead of pushing the CIA to re-examine its data or obtain better data, Bush was content to rely on Tenet's reassurance. And indeed, he often failed to ask experts and relevant officials probing questions, including what they thought about an issue, and even when it came to going to war, he didn't ask many of his chief advisors their opinions. The president was focused on getting to a bottom-line solution and then figuring out how to sell his policies and how to implement his policies. And those are very important things. But the most important is, what should the policy be?
One thing that he and Vice President Cheney said they really wanted to accomplish, they worked hard to do this, is to restore the presidency powers that they thought had slipped away post-Watergate. Did they succeed at that, or is what we've seen there a one-president-only thing?
You know, they certainly made a number of assertions of executive power. Some of it is in signing statements, of which there are hundreds of signing statements where the president has declared that he would not follow a certain aspect of a law because it was unconstitutional, because it impeded on the president's discretionary authority. We actually don't know yet the real consequence of this, and of course another president could see this differently and see his duties and responsibilities differently. Similarly, the president made a number of assertions regarding detainees, and that's probably the most prominent aspect of the rather bold set of assertions of executive authority of the Bush administration. But the president, although he got some of what he wanted, he certainly has been slapped down by the Supreme Court in several instances, and in some ways you could say that actually weakened the presidency, because when you push things to an extreme and you force a decision, and courts are generally reluctant to make decisions about such matters, then it's there as a precedent. So it doesn't seem to me that he's leaving the office substantially different than he found it.
His legacy. We are looking at a president who leaves office with his approval ratings at record lows for any president, as long as they've been keeping track of such things. What are the chances that he'll be able to rehabilitate himself in history and come across looking better than he does as he leaves office?
Well, certainly if Iraq should turn into a stable democracy and a model for the Middle East, that will be a huge plus in his legacy. I think that it remains to be seen the impact of the No Child Left Behind Act. It remains to be seen how we can deal with the enormous deficits that we've run up during the Bush administration and whether that will be a big burden for future generations or not. We'll just have to see. But if it isn't a burden, then people won't be thinking about it. I don't think that there's much you can do about what I would say not being on top of all issues, not having planned for the aftermath of Iraq. That was a disaster, and there's nothing that can rehabilitate that.
And likewise, something like Hurricane Katrina.
That was a disaster, and there's no new perspective that's going to change that. And I might add, although it's very complex and there's lots that we don't know, not being on top of, not anticipating the economic turndown and then financial crisis that we're experiencing right now is, again, something that's certainly not all his fault, and it's never fair to blame everything on a president. But certainly doing very little to anticipate this or preempt it or prevent it is not going to look well in history, no matter how well we ultimately come out of this, and it'll probably take a year or two before we actually come out of it.
Any thoughts on what we will see and hear from George W. Bush in the coming years?
Well, I think that the president would like to do good, and there's lots of ways to do that. I think he's aware that Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter have certainly been very active, and I suspect that he still has to decide for himself where to focus his energies, and they can be considerable energies, and he can do a lot of good for the world, I think. His presidential library will be concerned with promotion of democracy, with the promotion of, I think, some faith-based issue orientation. And I think also, though, that there's still plenty of room for him to carve out a niche for himself, and I hope that he does.
George Edwards, thank you very much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Looking for a New Year's resolution that's easy to keep?